Guys, welcome back to another episode of Tay Talks. I hope you've enjoyed whatever you've listened to so far. And if this is your first episode that you're listening to, I get to talk to Peter DeMaria, who is a friend of Felix, actually. So if you listened to Felix's episode, you got to see our dynamic there. Something that I walked away from talking to Peter was how pain and bad things, in quotes, because life is life and things happen. But things that we would mark as bad or sad, you know, he lost his mother. He took that pain and all those negative feelings that come with it and was able to become that a person that was in his shoes would have needed, or a person that his mother would have needed. As a patient advocate, I always advocate for patients to see pain management and palliative care early on in their journey. So it's really cool to see somebody who's done both. So I'm really excited for you guys to listen to this episode. Speaking of pain, though, I was in pain, and I don't know if you guys can tell. I feel like you'll definitely be able to tell, though. So a little backstory for the day of this episode. The weather was nice. It's Florida. I shouldn't say that. Decent. I'm not going to say nice because I think it was like in May or something. Anyways, it's not supposed to be traditionally boiling in May. And I wanted to film outside. Also had a meeting across town from where I live. And so I was trying to find a place where I could film this podcast and position myself in a place where I could, you know, make both. Anyways, I decide to get a coffee, sit outside, got to the cafe. I said, maybe not a coffee. Let's do an iced like drink. Glad I did that. Sat outside. And I picked the shadiest spot. There was a big tree above me. There was a tent kind of above me. All was good. You see me slowly die. You see me slowly melt as this podcast goes on. And then I disappear because my equipment overheated. So I had two cameras, both overheated, my phone and my camera. I think the sun is what got the best of me, because really I should have just said, time out, Peter. This is recorded. This is not live. I can go walk inside. We can have half the podcast filmed inside, half filmed outside. Totally would have been acceptable. No, instead of just going inside like a normal person would have done, I decided I'm going to weather the storm and I'm going to stay outside and I'm going to be fine. I had a little fan with me. It died after like 5 minutes. So you see me slowly melt kind of like into a puddle. My face is dripping. I'm like wiping sweat and then the camera dies, and then you just get to see Peter, which is definitely for the best. The other kicker is, after I filmed this episode, called my cousins and my sisters and I said, I can't believe what just happened, blah, blah, blah. I was dying. They're like, it's not that bad. It's not that bad. I'm sure it's not that bad. It was that bad. When they watched, they said it was that bad. So the concept was, maybe we post just the video of him and I in the beginning and then we cut it to just Peter for the rest of the video. But I said, you know what? It's fine. I'll just explain what happened and, you know, it's fine. It's fine. If you're listening, you're not going to know I was dying, you know? So it's really a non-issue. But yeah, conversation was super fun. Really enjoyed it. I hope you do too. And if you feel like you gained something, share it with somebody who you think will benefit too. If you haven't listened to everything else that's up wherever you get podcasts, please give it a listen. There will be a corresponding blog post with every episode. So be sure to look out for that. And we'll talk soon.
Yeah.
But then you hit the real world and you're like, you can't be so weird in the real world, you know. You have to fit in.
Kind of. I mean, we have like napping pods at work that we've all discovered. So, you know, you find those under the desk moments.
So I think a takeaway for a listener is, you can be eccentric, you can be an individual and still have a good career and still achieve. Just realize that individuality will cause friction in your life. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have an identity anymore as Peter the student. I wasn't Peter the caretaker of my mother. I wasn't Peter of, I had a long-term girlfriend that we broke up. So I'm going to go be Peter the cancer doctor as a way out of that experience. This other component was, I didn't really have any control during my mother's illness and death. My parents didn't tell me much. I found out that my mother had breast cancer diagnosis from my neighbor on AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
100 duck-sized horses.
Why?
I feel I could take 100 duck-sized horses or ducks. I could deal with 100 ducks.
They're 100 horses.
They're this big.
Okay. I'm voting a one.
I'd rather take on 100 little critters this big.
I can't stand a cockroach, so I'm going to go with the one horse-sized duck. Okay, all right. If we're ever in an apocalypse, I'll call you. Anything that is off limits that I can't talk about, I can't bring up?
Or... No.
Okay.
I'll give you honest opinions. Some of the questions wanted more creative part of the brain. I'm not very creative. Most of
that's
the
okay. Neither
I
am
I. Think I have autism. Like, I don't have that capacity for creativity or much imagination. So, like, usually I would use ChatGPT to come up with an answer for a creative thing, but I just thought I'd tell you.
No,
I'm better with literal. You know, I usually use ChatGPT to write my cards for the people that I'm dating.
Do you?
Don't tell anybody.
Has anybody picked up on that?
That's,
so you're plagiarizing your dating game? Like, how's that working?
Yes. Otherwise, every single card I write is the exact same. It has the date in the upper corner of it.
Okay.
And as I reflect back upon the year, and you put like, I said, this is how I think, reflect back and blah, blah, blah. I'm so happy for you. It's like a robot writing feelings.
That's okay.
So that's why sometimes you need a little ChatGPT for your dating life.
No, I don't think so. I think that may be why you're still dating, is because people are not getting to know the real you.
Yes, this is, hence the 40 and autistic thing, you know, who knows?
I think we're all somewhat on the spectrum, right?
If you're
in the healthcare field, I feel like you've got it. It's, no, I don't think you should use ChatGPT. See? Good. I have a whole... like box of fidget things because I tutor this kid during the week and her parents are like, oh no, she's not anywhere on the spectrum or she's not ADHD and she's not anything. And I'm like, if she's not running laps around the library while we're working, she's not getting any work done. She needs to fidget.
People can think what they want.
Exactly. I'm like, well, I'll take care of her. I got you. Really excited that Felix connected us because
thank you for having me.
I think that it's very easy in academia and in the work life in general to see that people are, you know, unidimensional and that, okay, you have a job and you wear this white coat and people never actually know the behind the scenes. So my goal with this is anybody listening will know the person behind Peter DiMaria. Reading through everything, it wasn't your credentials that got me. I found it to be a fascinating arc to go from palliative care to the FDA and now into phase one. So we'll get into the nitty gritty, but what's one surprising or unexpected thing that most people in your professional world actually don't know about you?
Most people know most things about me because I'm in a blab too much and most people know like exactly what's going on in my life. So yeah, I think people know everything. So the biggest difficulty I have in my life is I overshare because of a need to feel understood by others. And I do believe that through sharing our experiences, you find that you're less alone in human existence, right? Even if it's some like funny, odd thing or embarrassing thing, you know, if you share that with 100 people, even if it's an like you might find that one person saying, you know, I have that same thing or that same fear or weird habit or whatever it is. I feel less lonely in life by oversharing. That's something that gets me into trouble.
So, do you ever regret it? Because I'm also an oversharer and I'm an open book. And I sometimes...
Not really. I only regret it causes me difficulty.
Yeah.
I am like, man, that caused difficulty. But no, I like who I am. And I really be with the way that I operate. And I think people are packages. You take the good with the bad. It's like dating. You know, you accept the package, 100%. You reject the package. And not everyone is going to like everything about you. It doesn't matter if that's a family member, if that's somebody that's like a, you know, romantic significant other, if it's somebody that you work with. And I think there's too much in society of trying to get people to change, to fit a particular mold. It's just like, let people be people.
Do you feel like you've always been that way from when you were a kid? Or,
Or
love that.
I have been in trouble since I was in first grade for blurting things out. And, you know, then I had to go play Uno with the psychologist.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, my whole...
In
it's
first
like,
grade?
This is, yeah. So, like, who I am deeply as a person is... like, this is just who I am.
I love it.
For better or for worse. Now, it doesn't mean people can't change, you know, within the spectrum of their capacity. But that's just like, you have to conform to society to a certain extent, right?
extent.
So I was like fortunate. I went to a very, this is private school in Miami called Ransom Everglades that I loved. Okay. And I'd always gone to private, like to Montessori schools, which is all work at your own pace, or these private schools where you could be really smart and there was no cool or uncool based on clique, and your eccentricities could be appreciated.
Yeah.
Like I didn't like to wear shoes, for instance. I really hated shoes. Or I might like take a nap under a desk at a random time and people are like, oh, it's Peter being Peter. He's just a little weird.
Yeah,
it's okay.
I love that.
And that wouldn't have worked in a lot of settings. So I just was fortunate that.
I love that. Yeah. That you
that worked in my earlier years. But then you hit the real world and you're like, you can't be so weird in the real world. You know, you have to fit in.
Kind of. I mean, we have like napping pods at work that we've all discovered. And when I'm looking for some of the medonks, I know exactly which napping pod. They're not actually napping pods. Yeah. They're just corners of the hospital that people go to hide. So, you know, you find those under the desk moments.
So I think a takeaway for a listener is you can be eccentric. You can be an individual and still have a good career and still achieve. Just realize that that individuality will cause friction in your life. And you have to be okay with that, accepting of it to a certain extent. And find that people, not everybody will like you, and you need to find the people that your style works with and have them be your champions and navigate the people that don't appreciate your style and survive. Yeah. And that's a lot of life, you know?
Absolutely. All right, this is semi-creative, but not really. Would you rather fight one horse-sized duck or 100 duck-sized horses?
100 duck-sized horses.
Why?
I feel I could take 100 duck-sized horses. They're ducks. I could deal with 100 ducks.
No, they're 100 horses.
They're this big.
Okay, I'm voting one.
I'd rather take on 100 little critters this big.
I can't stand a cockroach, so I'm going to go with the one horse-sized duck.
I guess I have no problem swishing a cockroach for a spider.
Okay,
like
all right. If we're ever in an apocalypse, I'll call you.
Yeah.
Okay, so economics. You started with economics. How'd we get to medicine?
Yeah, I really liked economics as a decision-making science. So I never thought I was going to be a doctor. I was always good academically. Everything that I did, except languages. Languages were harder for me. So I went to college thinking I'd probably go work for like the CIA or the State Department or in politics. I liked economics. So what I liked is a decision-making science.
Okay.
I also liked taking tests more than writing long papers. But I really liked how it taught you to think about the world. And I had great teachers at Dartmouth. It was a wonderful undergraduate experience. I had enough credits to graduate in 3 years and I had already skipped fourth grade. So I took junior year off and I worked as a White House intern for half the year in the Political Affairs in 2005, which was a really great experience. But during that time, I had read an article. So in my job in political affairs, I was in the Southeast region. So I would read the newspaper from Texas to Florida to North Carolina, and you'd write like an abstract about issues facing the administration. So let's say at the time of the George W. Bush presidency, he's going to Jacksonville to push Social Security reform. So he grabs the binder for Florida and Jackson to see who the reps, who all the local people are, and then the articles that I'd write about, like, oh, here, what's going on in the area. So in, say, Jacksonville, the USS John F. Kennedy was being decommissioned, which was an older aircraft carrier, and that's a big economic driver. So what happens if the administration person goes to that area to push whatever their agenda is that they're pushing, and then the local reporter says, but, you know, what's your opinion on the decommissioning of this aircraft carrier? Because it's a big economic driver. So that you need to have responses for that. Right. So that was my job. In reading the paper each day, I read an article on people going back to school doing these post-bac programs to do careers in medicine. And I didn't think much of it. I'm like, well, that's interesting. Okay, I'll get right on that article. And at the end of that internship, my mother was diagnosed with breast cancer my freshman year. She had leptomeningeal recurrence. So I left like a couple weeks early. I went home to deal with things. I went back and finished out to get my pictures with, like, you know, president, vice president, like all the swag. All the So, I mean, it was like 6 month long. So it was just like the last couple weeks of it. So I spent the rest of the year taking care of her, which was a very important experience. Mm-hmm. It wasn't a happy one, certainly, but I had a lot of purpose in it. And I really liked being in that world. And so during that time, I'd ask all the doctors, like I said, oh, do you like this? Do you not? Because I wasn't set on a job. I remember like the neurosurgeon complaining. He's like, you know, I just put this Ohmyo reservoir as a port for chemotherapy. I just put this in your mother's head and it costs more to fix my car than I got reimbursed. So the guy's complaining about this, right? And then, you know, I met this cardiologist that I really liked, Miami, old guy. And he said to me, he was like, hey, what do you think about me going back to school to medicine? And he said, like, you have this degree in economics, you should make sure that that's not what you want to do first, because it is a huge commitment in terms of time and treasure and cost, the opportunity cost of giving up income for those years, plus your tuition, cost of living, all that. So make sure that this is what you want to do first. So, okay, so I took care of my mother until September. My father's an attorney and was, you know, working to support us and pay the bills. And I'm an only child. I was like a primary caretaker. So I went back to Dartmouth my senior fall and did corporate recruiting.
Okay.
And all the posts were like New York, San Francisco, and then one was Miami Beach. And there was a good company that was the biggest commercial mortgage-backed securities investor. So if you ever watched The Big Short, like the bonds that were collateralized by commercial mortgage cash flows. So like that industry, and the guy I interviewed with went to my high school and went to Dartmouth. And I'm like, okay, you know, this is a guy I interviewed with them and I had an offer. And I made a decision, okay, let me go home because my mother's either going to be alive, in which case I want to spend time with her, or she's not going to be, in which case I want to be around my father. So I accepted that offer and said, look, let me give this a shot. She did not survive to the end of that year, which is, you know, it's how I got into this line of work. Because I never met, you know, so many oncologists with, you know, dead parents. It's really like, it's a common story.
It is. This area.
I went back home in 2006 and I took this job, and it was really great for me for a while because I was depressed and I got to go and sit in an office and be depressed and do my spreadsheeting as a financial analyst. And I started with a group of guys who were all kind of like the same age. So there was a peer group, which was important for me. And it gave me time to be sad and process things. It was my first post-college job. And you think, you know, you spend all these years of being a good student and you get self-esteem from being a good student. And then you're not in school anymore, right? You're not taking tests. You're not getting validation that way, right? It's like, this is the real world. Okay. So I didn't have an identity anymore as Peter the student. I wasn't Peter the caretaker of my mother. That became a big part of my identity. I wasn't Peter of, I had a long-term girlfriend that we broke up. So I really was looking for an identity. And I made a decision. I'm going to go be Peter the cancer doctor.
Yeah.
As a way out of that experience. This other component was I didn't really have any control during my mother's illness and death. My parents didn't tell me much. I found out that my mother had breast cancer diagnosis from my neighbor on AOL Instant Messenger.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, because my parents didn't want to tell me from being in college. They didn't want, you know,
and then I came back. How long did they keep it from you?
Month or two initially. I came back for spring break my freshman year. My dad goes at the airport. We have to have a family conversation. I go, oh, you mean about mom's cancer diagnosis? He goes, what? How did you know? I'm like, oh, the neighbor's. Because the neighbor's mother was a breast cancer researcher that she was talking to.
Oh.
So then my neighbor is my friend. You know, we used to go paintballing together.
Yeah.
So that's how I, you know, found out. And so we didn't really have conversations about, you know, where things were. I think the first couple of years, it's like, okay, you know, people get cancer. It's not such a big deal in my mind. Like my so my family's also all BRCA1. Mutant, you know, this is like a big thing in my family. Unfortunately, I'm negative, but like people in my family, like my grandmother survived breast cancer at 29 and 31, was treated at 1960 in Roswell Park in Buffalo and survived. She's one of three girls. One sister died in her 40s. The other one didn't have it. Her mother died in 1936 when my grandmother was six.
You know,
you know, generation after generation. So we were tested in the early days.
So you knew to expect.
Genetics test. Yeah. My mother never did the prophylactic mastectomy, which now, you know, okay, Angelina Jolie, she does this. She's on the news. It's a thing people do.
But then, it wasn't at the time.
It wasn't. She had this idea that the closer she could get to menopause, you know, like every year is like, if she went to menopause, she wouldn't get BRCA1 related, you know.
Yeah.
Which is not correct. Because when she finally was diagnosed, she was even doing mammograms every 6 months. She was diagnosed with stage 3C, which is like very high likelihood of recurrence. And then when she recurred, she had CNS recurrence and her leptomeninges, which was really terrible. It was like a lot of neurologics. It was like having meningitis for eight months. And you know, screaming every day. We'd have a baby monitor that we would just have to turn off because there's only like psychologically so many hours that you can handle that, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, like looking at that, I really had what you'd call like post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
Where you live in this chronic state of stress for a long time and then the stressor's gone, right? She dies.
You don't know how to function without it.
I couldn't turn the stress off.
Right.
So I was very much consumed by this and wanted to know everything about this. And like some people go towards stressors, some go away, right? Like my father went like opposite direction. I have like other friends who's had dead parents and other doctors and wanted nothing to do with this one. Like when totally opposite direction. But for me, I was really consumed by it and wanted to know everything about it, read everything about it and be part of it. And that's kind of what put me on this path of the control aspect of not being in control and wanting to understand things. The feeling around patients with cancer and their family, there's this sense of understanding.
Another level of empathy, right?
Yeah, well, I used to go on message boards when my mother was sick on online and like try to find people to talk to. Yeah. What I ended up finding was like maybe high school classmates, because like, then it's odd to have a dead parent, right? When you're in seventh grade. And I'd reach out to those people and talk to them about their experiences as a way to deal with my crap, right? So that helped. But being in this world work-wise, for me, has always been like, I'm with my people. It's easier for me to feel understood there. Yeah. Now it would lead to interesting relationships. Like I had a lovely patient who died of acute leukemia who was my age when I was in training. Yeah. And she was an only child and her mother and I are still close. Like call the mother on her birthdays because who else is going to call her? It's terrible. She's like pushing 70 now and you have no kid and you're like, you want to see your kid grow up and get married and have kids. And that family part is big. You know, I didn't plan though to go to the NIH and get into clinical research.
Yeah.
I think this is really important for listeners. The choices you make have consequences. So for medical school, I had scholarship to the University of Miami. It was home. I was very secure, like in my little bubble at home.
Yeah.
So I was there from 09 to 13. I thought about leaving for residency and I looked at the match list. It's usually good to, you know, train at different places, but I looked at the match list and it was good places for that program. And Jackson has very good, there's a huge county hospital, there's the university hospital, there's a cancer center, and there's a VA. I said, okay, you have like myriad clinical experiences, I'll get a good foundation there. And in one of our educational, I didn't plan to be hospice, you know, doctor first. In one of the educational sessions, the guy who was the hospice palliative care fellowship program director noticed I'd sit in the front row. I took an interest in it because I really liked pharmacology and pain management from seeing like my mother's terrible death and inadequate pain management. So I would ask questions and he goes to me after, he's like, hey, would you be interested in doing this fellowship, staying into it? It's like a newer fellowship that we have here. And I said, listen, I would be an oncologist. I'm cool doing this as long as you support that that's what I want to do professionally. Yeah. And so ultimately it was one extra year of life. I thought it was great training, not only about what options are available to patients to give them guidance through that time. So that fellowship program director, Kinzaw, had a line that he'd give. He's like, about our role, it's like, patient's a passenger on the ship and the ship is in rough waters and it's going to the destination that it's going to. But your job as kind of captain of that ship is to guide it as gently as possible to its destination. So you can do that by good pain management, good symptom management, and communication. Because I think oftentimes like, people don't get the communication that they need to understand what's going on to normalize what is an abnormal experience.
Right.
Most people, if you live long enough, deal with death and loss and whatnot. So just knowing that these are expected things. So I thought that that was really important to do. It allowed me to take also my internal medicine boards during that year.
Yeah.
And I had time to apply to all these fellowships. So it was a good experience. Actually made a difference in my clinical trials experience.
Yeah.
Being able to put patients on study. So it was a good year. I'll tell you the downside of it, though. So by the end of that year, I would have dreams where I would be seeing the faces of, you know, like dying patients. So it's also a lot emotionally.
Yeah.
It's different than oncology. So in oncology, a lot of patients you're seeing are getting, you know, adjuvant treatment, meaning, you know, you have surgery, you have a systemic drug given after the surgery to reduce the likelihood that your cancer is going to come back or to delay the time when it comes back. Okay. So those are curative intent patients. For patients on study, like, so when I was at the NCI, we generally wouldn't have oncology patients die there. Every so often you do, because what happens, somebody would come for clinical trial and eventually they go off study because let's say the drug stops working and you have tumor progression or you come off the drug because you have a toxicity, then patients would go back to their respective institutions.
You wouldn't see them during that.
You wouldn't see it. So it was a lot of death. It was very important, I think, to have. So for fellows in oncology training, don't get that much palliative care. It's been good that there's a movement to increase the exposure of folks to this through their oncology training, but it's really not sufficient. It's like, I think, 4 weeks.
Yeah.
Is
it mandatory?
Yes, yeah. People do it, but it's hard to get good at pain management and to learn all
when
that
you're
you
not,
need to know
yeah.
just for 4 weeks, right?
Right, right.
I don't think you need a full year of it either. I'd say probably 6 months is the right amount of time. So for me, I used it as I got the education that I wanted. I did my internal medicine boards. I applied to fellowships. I got my first choice at the NIH. So for me, it worked out. But
yeah.
That costs a year of your life, right? There's a huge financial opportunity cost. So I was fortunate. I came out of this with the loans. But if you're somebody that is like, okay, you know, I'm paying, like that's a year you could be an attending, for instance.
Right.
Right. So there is a big economic cost to every year of training that you're doing. I just was fortunate that I was in the position where my father said, like, listen, he saw himself as this patron of cancer care because of the experience that he went through. And his way of dealing with it was to fund me doing this so that, you know, I was able to do what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
So appreciative of that. And so fortunate. So again, I think a great experience to understand what really is available to patients at home. So during that year, I worked for Vitas Hospice as a contractor.
Okay.
Who also sponsored the fellowship program. And I would go do home visits to see folks at home receiving hospice care and being their doctor that would go to.
And they were oncology hospice or just hospice in general?
All types. So okay. There's all kinds of criteria that, you know, could qualify you for hospice. And while there's a lot of good services that are provided by hospice,
yeah,
you also see what isn't provided. And that was really important, not just getting the pitch from hospice company to say, hey, you know, let us take over your insurance benefit, right? We'll take over your care, which is good in many situations, but there's
right.
only so much also that can be done.
Right.
And, you know, patients really need to understand what they're signing up for when they enroll with hospice. There's really, you need to think of it. There's two levels of care. There's a low level of care and high level of care. And that low mm-hmm. and high refers to the reimbursement that that hospice company can collect for the services provided. So at a low level of care, let's say, like, so you have a life-limiting prognosis, life expectancy of 6 months or fewer, you enroll in hospice, that hospice company charges your insurance, say $200 a day, like what they collect,
yeah,
give or take, every day that you're there. And they will bring the medications to your house. If you need, you know, some durable medical equipment, they can provide that. But you're not going to the hospital anymore. You're
right.
like, doing lab work or whatnot. Let's say they think, oh, maybe you have a pneumonia. Okay, we're going to give you some antibiotic pills and see if you get better. But if you
but
don't.
They're not testing. They're not checking.
Yeah, there's no diagnostic. Because the whole idea is to keep you out of the hospital. Right? That's a low level of care. Then you have something happen that qualifies you for that high level of care, which you need to make sure that you qualify for it hourly. So you have a pain crisis, you're actively dying, you're short of breath, anxiety, whatever. Then they justify that close to like $1,000 a day reimbursement. Now, the hospice company would like to keep you at that high level. It's not that they don't want to provide services, but in order to legally bill at that high level, you have to meet those
criteria.
Hospice companies, it's like a big deal. They get audited and, you know, it's like, it's a big concern. You don't want to be overbilling if you're the hospice company, right? So that is what funds the services that they provide. So a patient may think, I'm going home to get out of the hospital and I'm going to get nursing care. Like if you have a loved one, you can't shower them on your own. The hospice isn't providing the nursing care.
No.
They might be able to send somebody to help a couple hours a week with that, but it's not nursing care. It replaces the medications, the diagnostics, the hospital stuff and the clinic stuff, but it doesn't replace like home nursing care.
Right.
But that high level of care with hospice can be provided in a nursing home. So let's say you're in a skilled nursing facility that you're paying for. You either have a long-term care policy or your family's paying out of pocket for. You can have hospice with care given at the skilled nursing facility. You can have that high level of care or low level, right, given at home also. Or if you had an emergency, many hospices will have an inpatient facility where they contract out with the hospital. You can either flip a bed, like an individual bed, to turn it into a hospice bed, or the hospice company might say, we're going to rent out a floor or half a floor of a hospital that'll be our inpatient unit where if somebody has a pain crisis, we can bring them in, you know, see if they can get better. So there's these different levels of care and that it's really important for patients and their families to understand what the care levels are. Because what happens often is hospice company will say, you know, they have people who are out, right, in a sales role, trying to get patients to enroll on hospice. That's their job. There's nothing wrong with that. Right? But they're incentivized to bring people in, right? That's their business. If the family thinks they're getting one service and they don't get that, their experience with that hospice care will be negative, ultimately.
Right. And it's more of an education issue.
So yes, there's a lot of this education to sit down and say, here's what services are available and here's what's not available.
And that's not something that oncologists, you know, have, right? I mean, that's unique to you because you most don't. You're sending your patient, you call the social worker in and they sign them up for hospice. And that's the extent of your conversation. I mean,
there's
really
a lot of cultural conversations that are going on, right? So I was in Miami, big Hispanic population. It's like food, right? If you have a loved one, you feed them culturally. Yeah. Okay, well, at the end of your life, you don't need to be, certainly if you're hungry and you have your loved one at the end, feed them their favorite thing if they want, right? But people often aren't hungry. They don't want to eat. They're not thirsty. You might want to actually do the opposite. So oftentimes you use diuretics and medications to dry patients out to make them more comfortable. Because if somebody's not excreting, you know, water through the kidneys, they can become fluid overloaded and you have fluid buildup in your lungs. You can't breathe.
Right. Uncomfortable.
It's distressing to the patient. It can be distressing to families when, you know, loved ones are like making these gurgling sounds.
Yeah.
So what you might use is actually drugs that do the opposite, that dry patients out. But then you have to explain to families, like, you don't need to feed them. So I was, in the last week of my mother's life, waking up in the middle of the night to change batteries on an IV fluid pump, giving her IV fluids. Nobody had this conversation with me about you don't need to be doing that.
No.
I was, you know, stressing myself out, waking up in the middle of the night, wondering, is my mother's bag of saline going to run out, or if the batteries are going to die, and then she's going to die, right? That was my thought.
That's true. Yeah. Because, I mean, you don't know.
Yeah. So having those conversations are important and they take a lot of time.
Well, your patients are very lucky that they have you. It's unfortunate that you had to go through that, but I think it's made you a better caretaker for every patient that comes through, a more well-rounded, more holistic. I mean, like, your patients coming through your clinic are getting a conversation that they may need in another clinic to have 3-4 different conversations with different people, where you can provide that start to finish kind of perspective and understanding. And at what point do you think, you know, there's a big conversation in oncology about goals of care and making sure that all of that is discussed from the beginning to the end, and, you know, how palliation is not just an end of life introduction.
The goals of care thing is not really sufficient, even with like this push for a goals of care conversation.
Right.
So let's say you go to your physician and you talk about, oh, do you have advanced directives? It's like a yes or no type of, well, what does that mean?
What does that mean? Exactly.
Most states now will have a form called a MOLST or PULSED, physician order life sustaining treatment, or medical order life sustaining treatment. And that's not just like, do you want CPR? Do you want to be intubated?
Yeah.
That is, do you want IV vasopressors? Do you want IV antibiotic? Like, do you want a feeding tube? Like, let's say you have a stroke, for instance. Would you want to be kept alive with a feeding tube? You could live for a very long time with that. Yes, you might be aspirating and have recurrent pneumonias or whatnot. It's like, personally, I don't want to be kept alive with that. But just a basic, advanced directive question is not sufficient. Also, when you go to hospital, whatever, tomorrow, okay, and you do an intake form with whomever on the staff goes through what are your goals of care, and even this detailed form, that is only at that hospital or that facility. Or if you do it with your outpatient doctor and it's on that physician's electronic medical record, that doesn't mean that electronic medical record is going to flow into the EMR of the hospital if something happens to you. So I'll give you a story. My mother's mother, who had survived cancer at 29 and 31, she died at the ripe old age of 89 after cancer.
Aww.
But she had actually died in church like 4 years earlier. And she was DNR DNI, right? She did not want to be resuscitated.
Oh my gosh.
She was singing in the choir, very Catholic, in Buffalo, New York. And she dropped over dead. Her heart stopped. And EMS was activated. And she got shocked back to life.
Oh my goodness.
And she survived several more years. And my family and I, we joked, we should have just died then. She would have gone straight to heaven. She died in church.
She was in church. You guys ruined it for her.
The church, right? And the next couple of years of her life were not so good from a health perspective.
Yeah.
But just because she told her doctor, usually tell, you know, folks, especially who are older, right, is you get that MOLST form or POLST form completed. You fill it out with your doctor and your primary care doctor signs it. Mm-hmm. And then you put it on your fridge, like on a magnet. So that way, if something happens to you, neighbor finds whatever, and EMS comes, EMS has that. That's right. What you need. Or you tape it above the head of your bed.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
That's actually an important thing that folks, you know,
that is.
It's certainly a good thing to have these goals of care conversation, but it's an ongoing conversation.
It's an ongoing conversation. Right.
It changes depending on where you are in life's journey. Remember, you can't do everything, right, in medicine.
Like, no.
And I'll tell you, I was excellent with pain management. I don't do so much pain management anymore, right? You really skill, like, yes, it comes back to you. You can look it up.
When you need it, yeah.
So I think that it's important to realize that your eventual job that you're going to do tends to be more compartmentalized.
A little bit more siloed, right.
So it's great to have broad understanding of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
And not everybody needs to do an entire fellowship.
Right.
Do that. They need to have an interest in it, right? It's like
it's part of the disease, right?
Yeah.
It's not something you can separate from
education. Could take many forms. Like, you could buy a book on your own. You don't need to do a whole year of fellowship training to get good at pain management, right? There's so many resources now.
Yeah,
you know, online, text. Mm-hmm. I think there's like too many resources. Or you
there
can't
are
read
too it. Many. Yeah. I don't know what you think, but I think it's not so much you need to know a little bit of everything as much as it is you need to know where to find things and, you know, how to jump in and redirect, right? I think you get a lot of people who the response when they don't know something is, I don't know, that's not my area, ask somebody else, as opposed to, I don't know, I'm not an expert, and let me guide you to who is, and making sure that you do that handoff and you don't just leave that patient stranded.
I think pain management in the oncology space is still inadequate, fortunately, for a lot of patients. That if you live in a major city, so your proximity to a major city is a huge determinant of outcomes,
right,
as a fact, to resources, right? So if you live in a smaller market, or I had a patient in Naples, was like a retiree in Naples who saw in Miami and had pain and needed somebody to manage and could not get an appointment with anyone because all the snowbirds from the north
are down
all winter.
Yeah.
It was months to get an appointment. That's even a heavily populated part of Western Florida. Could not get an appointment for somebody to manage their, you know, all these opioid medications or all controlled substances. You know, like, it can be difficult. So I think a lot of pain management is still inadequate. I'll still see, you know, oncologists start patients on kind of like a first line, you know, pain medication, like an opioid plus Tylenol, which is really meant for more moderate pain because the Tylenol is dose limiting. And like, that's what's going on. Like, that shouldn't be the case because oncologists are really busy. It's very complicated. If you're seeing, if your community oncologist seeing 25, 30 patients in a day and you have 15 minutes for a follow-up, now you're trying to address the cancer itself. And that's really where palliative care came in. It's like, hey, you know, we'll hire somebody on the side. It's not a big revenue generator for a group or a healthcare system. But it allows the oncologists that are bigger revenue generators because of the dollars generated from infusional drug delivery, it gives them time to do that. And we'll handle the pain and symptom management. And then from a hospital perspective, there's cost savings because if you have somebody who has, you know, no hope of recovery and is intubated in an ICU and 90 years old, right, it doesn't make sense from an economic point of view to continue to care for that patient in the ICU.
Right.
So palliative care can be, you know, it's kind of markets itself as cost savings from a hospital perspective, particularly if you're looking at like length of stay metrics for hospitals. If a patient is discharged, say from a hospital service, internal medicine hospital service, to let's say the hospital pays for their own internal palliative care service, like an inpatient hospice, then that is a way for a hospital to improve the length of stay metrics.
Right. Yeah. Always comes back to the metrics.
But you learn a lot about the business of it as well as what's offered, and then, you know, better pain and symptom management.
Yeah.
So like working in clinical research, there's some interesting interplay with it. So like, I remember when I started off as a fellow at the NCI, I really liked methadone. So methadone, most people think of like a methadone clinic for folks who have like opioid, you know, substance abuse dependence issues, right? But that's because methadone has a really long half-life. There's two peaks in the pharmacology of methadone. So if you're using it as an opioid analgesic, meaning, you know, you're trying to fix somebody's pain, that's a 3 time a day dosed drug.
Okay.
But if you're using it for opioid abuse dependence, it's a once a day drug. Because you're not trying to get that analgesic effect. You're just trying make sure that there's enough drug hitting those opioid receptors so the person's not having cravings and withdrawals. If you're doing the opioid for opioid dependence indication, you generally need a separate endorsement on your medical license and so on. For pain, you do it three times a day. But methadone is a drug that's known to have cardiac toxicity. So it can delay cardiac conduction in the heart and cause QT prolongation. So I go to NCI where every patient is on phase one, phase two study. And the goal of these studies is, are there safety studies effectively? They're not efficacy studies. You're trying to determine what the safety profile is of a new drug. It hasn't been tested in humans before. Now we're going to go from the preclinical, i.e. cancer cell cultures or patient-derived xenografts, the mouse with the tumor growing on it, right? You're going to go from that to humans, and you're going to dose escalate and take blood at time points before and after to try to build a concentration curve of the drug over time. It's called pharmacokinetics or pharmacodynamics to see if there's a marker that shows the drug is active or not. You know, when you're doing that, you don't want to give a drug like methadone, which even though it can be a very good pain medication, if now you're giving that to fix somebody's pain and it's causing QT prolongation, you don't know if that QT prolongation is due to the investigational product that you're studying in clinic or to the methadone. In a phase one study, you have to capture everything, right? You don't want to say that here's a new toxicity for this drug that is not a toxicity, right? What if that toxicity kills the drug's development and this could be an otherwise useful drug? Yeah. So that's where, you know, there's this interplay between you bring your skill set from your prior experience to that new thing, and then it took some adapting on my part. It's like, okay, I didn't know that, right?
Yeah.
Where it's been particularly useful. So I had a case where I had a gentleman who I met in the pandemic, it was in 2020, who had a 1 in a million tumor called chordoma. Mm. Chordoma is in the world of sarcoma. Mm-hmm. And it comes from remnants of the primitive notochord. And he was in Oklahoma, and he was not doing well because he had progressed on all the different investigational. There's no approved systemic therapies. He'd been on a couple studies, and those weren't working anymore. And we had an investigational therapeutic cancer vaccine. So it was a vaccinia virus that was modified to express tumor antigen that's universally expressed on this rare tumor called Brachyury. And we wanted to put him on study, but we couldn't because his performance status, which is a term that encompasses basically how well are you doing? You know, are you up and walking? Are you in bed? Are you bedbound? Like, there are various metrics. There's a palliative scale, Karnofsky performance scale, and Eastern Cooperative Oncology Group performance scale. And those are built into studies, basically saying if you're too sick, you shouldn't go on the study. Right? If you're bedbound, not a good idea. Because the ideal kind of patient on one of these early phase studies is somebody that has an incurable cancer, hence them willing to go on a study of a new drug, but is healthy, right? Their organ function, their kidneys are working, their liver is working. I have a friend who was my patient at the NCI who was diagnosed in his late 30s with metastatic colon cancer that is still alive 8-9 years later now, who went on an investigational drug, benefited clearly from that investigational drug, and that drug never went to go on to be approved because there were issues with toxicity for that drug.
Right. But so not in his case. He was enough to.
He had toxicity.
But enough that he could get through it.
But he received a benefit first and then stopped it from the toxicity. For him, it's been a miracle. And we've gone skiing together many times. It's wonderful.
Yeah.
So just because something works for somebody doesn't mean it's going to lead to an approval. Just because something eventually gets approved doesn't mean even the dose
is going to work for everybody. Right.
It's going to work. Most of the patients aren't a majority, or working for a minority of patients. So I think these are all really important things to think about. But with respect to the incorporating the palliative care and hospice, so this patient in Oklahoma was not receiving appropriate pain management. So his performance status, that metric of how you're doing, whether or not you could go on the study, was below what was needed because he couldn't walk because he was in such pain.
Right.
So his church flew him to the NIH. We admitted him to the hospital. So, and we can talk about the different facilities there. So within the NIH in Bethesda, there's a gigantic hospital called Building 10, the Clinical Center. That's the world's largest clinical research hospital that all the various institutes and centers fund collectively. So it could be the National Cancer Institute where I was, could be National Heart, Lung, and Blood, could be NIAID, the Institute of Allergies and Infectious Disease. So you'd see a lot of protocols of folks who were immunocompromised. Let's say you had a genetic deficiency in a particular pathway that would fight infection. So a lot of those kinds of studies. So they would all use the clinical center as their hospital to conduct clinical research. So we admitted the patient. to the hospital under a standard of care protocol initially. I did his pain management, mm-hmm. so he was able to then receive appropriate analgesia. And then mm-hmm. with his pain under control, he was able to get up and walk, and his performance status was sufficient to put him on study. And he lived for another 2 years. It worked. His tumor had, you know, an amazing regression.
That's amazing.
I kind of point to that as, if I didn't have that experience where I wasn't comfortable managing that and saying, hey, I see why his performance status is so poor. It's not because he's so sick from the disease itself, because his pain management is inadequate. You know, that's ultimately what led to that positive outcome for him.
What do you think something is often misunderstood about early phase oncology in general? And then I guess what's your favorite thing about it? Because phase one is where I started oncology, and I love that.
So what I think it's cool is that you're always doing something new. It's exciting mm-hmm. when something new works.
Right.
Yes, there's the understanding that most of the investigational products that you see will not ultimately go on to be approved. But again, right. some lead to responses despite not being approved. And you don't know, because we're just responsible for the first step in human clinical research. You know, what we're doing is providing high quality data to the sponsor. So sponsor is a legal term. It really refers to the entity that is submitting an investigational new drug application to FDA, which is that license to conduct the study. So it's a license to ship the investigational product across state lines. So we are providing that sponsor, which for most new drugs developed is a drug company, either a large company, like a big pharmaceutical company, or a smaller biotech. We're providing them with that safety data and those blood tests before and after at various time points, the pharmacokinetic and pharmacodynamic data, to determine what the right doses that we should be using in our efficacy studies that could be leading to the approval of the drug. So I like being in that space, you know, doing the same thing all the time gets boring, right, for any human. So getting to do new is interesting. That's like the big juice for people in this space. Now, for me, what I also like is the patients who are coming are generally patients who've progressed on first-line standard of care therapy, on second-line standard of care therapy. There's not a whole lot of options left. And I get to be in the space where I have conversations, being that physician giving guidance about, you know, when hospice is appropriate, and being in that position to help guide people through that.
Right.
So I think it's something that allows me to combine my interests.
And then how do you compare the work at the NIH and the FDA to what you're doing now, being that you're still really focused on early phase studies?
So my job right now is very similar to components of both. Let's take the NIH first. So the role of government, as I see it, is to devote resources to areas that the private sector does not allocate resources to. You know, initially, nobody was doing any cancer research, right? So then you have the National Cancer Act, and federal government says, we're going to get into this space. And early drugs were developed from government intervention, just like if there's an island off the coast and there's no bridge to the island, and the government says, hey, we're going to use federal tax dollars, we're going to build a bridge, or state, if it's state, you know, we're going to build this bridge to that island. And then once the bridge is built, developers can go in there, they want to buy the land, build hotels, and then you generate tax revenue from that development, right? So that's kind of been the role of government in cancer drug development. So now most cancer drugs are developed from private industry. Now, the NIH Clinical Center offers sponsors the ability to conduct research that's subsidized by the U.S. taxpayer, right? So it might be slow to open up a study at the NIH, but you get the benefit of, if you're a small company and you don't have, you know, a big runway of cash, you can work with the government, and the government will fund it, and then it becomes intellectual property of the taxpayer, right? You have to publish the results of that study. So there's big benefits of working there and slow. So from that perspective, what we do here at Next is very similar, right? We're seeing patients on studies of investigational drugs that are early phase studies. Now, what's different is the NIH is focusing now, right, on things that the private sector doesn't allocate resources to. So a lot of rare diseases. I was working on chordoma, right? A pharmaceutical company might have difficulty saying to the market, hey, we want to fund the development on some rare disease. So let government focus on that. We're going to focus on cancers where there's a lot of patients with cancer, right? Lung cancer, breast cancer, colon cancer, those kind of big cancers, prostate cancer. So in the space of drug development, using community networks like Next. Most of our sponsors are focused on diseases that are more prevalent, and the NIH focus more on rare diseases. So a question I get a lot now is, you know, how will the federal cuts affect what you do? And I said, it's a different disease focus, common diseases to the more rare diseases. But the NIH was wonderful. And, you know, all the fellows who trained there, what you're really coming out with is the ability to conduct high quality research. That's why I say, like, could you go do that job and then go be a community oncologist in whatever city that you want to? You could do that. Why go train at the NIH?
Why do that?
It doesn't make sense, right? Because it is a national resource with those federal tax dollars. I think that, you know, a trainee would be better served to go to a different kind of place if they want is, you know, to go to whatever city that is their geographic preference and do right kind of like all-comer oncology, all different kinds of cancers, for instance, not drug development as much. And it's important because this isn't something that I thought of. Listening to this talk, as you pick your career, as you make your decisions will open some doors and close others. And here's what I mean. Like, so I had read The Emperor of All Maladies like 10 years prior to applying to. I love the history of the National Cancer Institute. I wanted to be part of that history. I was very, the NCI was my first choice, and I loved it. It was wonderful, wonderful place, the Cancer Disneyland, I'd say. It opened some doors. It closed others. So one of the things I had liked about medicine was the I can work anywhere type of thing. Maybe you want to go live in Alaska for a period of time.
Yeah.
And if you are doing normal medicine things, that is true. You can work pretty much anywhere. When you are in a niche thing like this, you cannot work anywhere.
Right.
So I think people need to understand that. And when you go to highly specialized places to train, whatever it is, and this is cancer or non-cancer,
right,
the more specialized you are, that can be desirable to certain things and not desirable to others. So for instance, why would a busy community practice want somebody who works in early phase drug development, who is a medical officer at the FDA, who knows regulatory work, who can help bring a new drug to market? How does that benefit the hospital in random city in America that just have patients with cancer that need to be treated? So if that's where you want to make your home, which is perfectly reasonable thing to say, let's say you have a significant other that's like, hey, my family is in Montana and we're going to go live in Montana. I like that, right? Realize that a highly specialized training in drug development is not going to translate to that. So I think it's really important because the training programs in any specialty that you go into, there's more like community-based places and then there's more fancy academic places. And even within academic, there's like different kind of tiers of these academic places. And what makes a place like fancy is their research funding, their subspecialization, and that's great if the city can support it. If you're in a major metropolitan area that has the patient population and like base to support such extreme subspecialization, wonderful. Like I spent a month at Johns Hopkins and they don't have like one leukemia doctor or two leukemia doctors.
Like 20.
Doctors. MD Anderson across is a fleet of leukemia doctors, right? So it's wonderful to have that, but you need to be able to have a unique place to have that scale to support that degree of subspecialization. So then if you become so subspecialized and you want to relocate to a different city, chances are you're not going to be able to maintain that subspecialization or whatever it is that you're doing. So I think that like, he's like, hey, you know, Peter had this interesting career and it's really true. I'm very happy with what I do. Just realize the more subspecialization you have will open doors for the places that need that subspecialization. But they're going to
close. And not everywhere needs it.
And not everywhere needs it. Yes.
What's something that you feel like you've unlearned or changed your mind about in the last year, personal or professional?
I think I've become more liberal in terms of healthcare, you know, in terms of the more inefficiencies I see. And this isn't a drug development thing. This is just healthcare in general. I don't really think that we have that much choice. Health insurance is tied to employment generally. For most Americans, you know, you have a couple options through an employer. So I don't think this idea of choice
exists really.
For most people is, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm very Western American, my thought of like individualism, right? But I think that maybe some element of collectivism could benefit us a bit more. I think it's hard to succeed if you don't have a basic level of healthcare, right? So
what does that look
now,
like
now? That
to
being
you?
Said,
or what do you envision it looking like here?
If you have a healthcare system that does not reimburse properly, you're going to see a slower pace of drug development. And these are trade-offs that in society you have to decide. For instance, like if a pharmaceutical company, which is a for-profit business that has a fiduciary responsibility to their investors, to their shareholders, if they can't generate a return on the huge investment to develop a drug that they think is sufficient, whatever that is, will they not develop that drug?
Right.
I mean, these are real trade-off. It's that financial incentive that pushes people to bring new, you know, products to market. And yes, everybody wants to bring new cancer therapy. Everybody that's at a drug company, that's an oncologist, yes, I'm sure that they want to do well, right? And they want to like hit their bonus. You want to approve new drugs. When I was at FDA and like pre-pandemic, it was great. You'd like have a new drug approval. We'd all get together and clap and we're happy. So there's not anybody, like, I think this is really important for people to understand also. And one of the reasons I wanted to be kind of on the inside, there's no conspiracies. There's no one saying, we should only develop this drug to help people a little bit, but they want to keep them sick enough that they need this forever. There's none of that. If you can get a home run, people would be there so fast. It said it's hard to develop new drugs.
Yeah, it's really hard. Is. That's why. And the body's so smart.
Yeah.
It just keeps outsmarting.
Yeah, there's no person in the back room holding a key to some vault with the cure in there.
No.
I spent 6 years on the inside. If you want to listen to what I say and believe me, great. I hope you do.
Yeah.
Now, people will disagree about should something be approved or not, right? Because people will come to different conclusions. But I never saw any unethical things. Look, I thought working at FDA is a great organization. I was very happy with my time there. I left because I didn't want to live in the cold in Washington, D.C. anymore.
It was just time. Sometimes you just get to a point where there's something that's next.
It was really gray. I really liked it. It was just really gray. And if I had met somebody, like on my personal life, maybe you met somebody and you get married and their family's up there, I would have stayed. But I didn't. And yeah. I like the South and I like the Mountain West.
The South is happy to have you.
These are really great organizations. Yes. Miami's my home. I spent 30 of my 40 years there, but I work in niche business. And not every place needs to have a robust phase 1 program, right?
No,
these are small studies.
Do you not think Miami needs it? I mean, I feel like you can bring this to Miami.
It's really not about the physicians. It's about the system. So what this model really offers is speed. So if you have a big university with lots and lots of layers that opens the study in 6 months to a year, by the time that study is opened, it'll have moved on, right? Because you might need 10 patients, 20 patients, 30 patients doing your initial dose escalation. So what sponsors need are high quality data and speed to move on, because you're not getting a drug brought to market from a phase 1 study. It's not intended to show efficacy. You hope that there's some efficacy, but it's not intended to show that you can't. So you need to get the data to get the dose right to then move on with your drug development program. So what I try to educate folks on is that I really like university models for efficacy studies because of the doctors there. They're in clinic 2 days a week. They have the research expertise and time to conduct those studies. So if you have a drug that it's a study that's leading to that approval in a particular indication in the lung cancer, I want doctors who are treating lung cancer that have the time to conduct that. And they have a group of patients coming in with that type of cancer. If you have a phase 1 study that are often all comers, right? Unless it's, you know, a particular targeted drug. But if you have this drug that's open to all different kinds of cancer, what you really want is you want to work with a group that has patients with various cancers who are willing to send them to you for your study. And you want to open quickly and you want to have investigators. So we're really academic doctors who are working in partnership with community practices, because the community practices have, most patients are seen in the community, not the big referral center.
I see. Yes.
And the community doctors are in clinic all day long. They're very busy. They think clinical research is good, but don't have the time to be the doctors conducting it yourself, because there's a lot of regulatory paperwork that we have to do. It takes a lot of time. So what can happen is if they have the patients, we have the research expertise, we partner with them, we'll treat patient on study. When the patient is no longer on the study, they go right back to that referring oncologist. That's different than universities.
Right, where
there are hospital systems in competition with group practices. So it's really essential to maintain the referring relationship so that patients have access to the studies. that the referring oncologists are comfortable sending those patients to clinical trials. So again, it's a different model.
It's a different model. Yeah, and a different need. And
I think academic models are great, but realize what they're good for. They're good
for what their limitations are.
Phase studies.
Right. We need a large volume of patients. And yeah.
And that's why you don't see a lot of universities that have tumor agnostic phase one programs. Because the model for most is you'll have a group doing lung cancer, a group doing colon cancer, so on and so forth.
Get everybody on the same page.
And then, so what happens if you have, let's say you have a sponsor, they say, we have this new drug that we want to do a study in breast cancer and lung cancer and whatever other cancers. Okay, say breast and lung. And I'm a breast cancer doctor. And you bring it to me and I say, hey, I want to do this. But I now need the lung person to sign on also. So then I talk to my counterpart on the lung side and they say, we don't want to do this. We have a study that's competing for the same patients for this, right? Then I can't open that study because I don't have the other patients. I don't have that support from that other doctor. So that's the downside of having the disease focus teams. It's great having disease focus in terms of you have expertise that is subspecialized. But if you want to bring a study in that has multiple different tumor cohorts, you need the buy-in from all of those.
From everybody.
Yeah.
Anybody listening who is maybe starting in medicine or in research in general, what would be one thing that you would leave them with?
My fellowship program director had this line, Mario Belusic, wonderful guy. And he'd talk about doctors being the kings or queens of delayed gratification. And it's a very long road. Like, so I am very happy my life now and with what I'm doing. But I was not happy in medical school or in residency. It's difficult. Like the lack of control over your life. I missed over half the weddings I ever got invited to. You know, so as you'd see people move on with their lives and there is this like delay of like these developmental milestones that I felt happened because of the number of years that happened.
Yeah.
The number of years that the training requires. So I think that realizing that the outcome is very satisfying is important during all the years of crap you're eating.
Okay.
So
it's worth it.
A long road, but it's worth it. So when I had my finance job, I asked myself, okay, would I want my boss's job? No. But then I said, would I want his boss's job? And the answer was still no.
That's when you knew it wasn't it.
Yeah. So I think if you can look at the end and say, would I like that job? And not just do it from some like, I hear all these people in medical school. I want to do Rhodes. I want to do radiology. Deal with that. Because it was some dermatitis, some lifestyle thing, whatever. Okay. Don't do this job if you think it's like for economic incentive or lifestyle.
You make a lot more money elsewhere.
Yeah. My friends doing finance made a lot more. Okay. So don't get into this if that's what you want to do. If you think, okay, this could be, yes, a job where you can have a steady life, right, and provide for your family, but you like the validation that comes with patient care, for instance. If I meet people that aren't as into patient care, but really like the intellectual aspect, okay, and that's fine, right? And realize there's a lot of subspecialties that don't require patient care. Like if you're a pathologist or a radiologist or whatnot, and those are really interesting things to do. Like I love my pathology rotation. Radiology was, but I didn't like being on the chair all day. So medicine is a big space and there's a lot of things to do in medicine. Yeah. But I also think that like there's a lot of places to train and you don't need to go to the fanciest place. Like if you what you want to do is to be a good internal medicine doctor, there's a lot of places that give you good training. You don't need to go to the research place to get the good clinical experience. And these academic rankings are based on often research dollars, number of publications, things like that. So think ultimately about like what is your goal at the end of the day.
Right. Thank you. This has been incredibly enlightening. And I think anybody listening is going to have a whole new world.
If you have a listener that has like a career question that wants to ask me, it's always like, it's important to pass on the info to the next generation, like pay it forward. And as much as I don't like to think that I'm getting older, so, you know, I hope this has been useful. And
absolutely. Question that you would leave for the next person that's on here.
No, that's like one of those creative
No,
things.
Okay.
Right. I just ask questions when they come to me.
I love it.
Sorry.
No, you're good.